5 UTC right after the international news.
Good evening and welcome to Straight Talk Africa. Vincent McCoury is sitting in for Shaka Sali. Today we take a look at the elections in Ghana.
Distinguished ladies and gentlemen, on the basis of the foregoing election results and by the power vested in me as the chairperson of the Electoral Commission of Ghana and the returning officer of the presidential election, it is my duty and honor to declare Nana Addo Dankwa Akufo-Addo as President-elect of the Republic of Ghana. May God bless our homeland, Ghana, and make our nation great and strong. Let peace reign.
Well, after a tightly contested election that took place on Monday, incumbent President Nana Akufo-Addo of the New Patriotic Party wins a second term in office, beating John Mahama of the National Democratic Congress Party with 51.59%. Of the vote.
Ghanaians have been partying through the night, celebrating a hard-fought second term in office for President Nana Akufo-Addo. The Election Commission said on Wednesday that the incumbent had won Monday's vote, with nearly 52%, fending off a challenge from old rival John Mahama, who secured over 47%. Addressing his supporters, Akufo-Addo said he would now turn his attention to the economy.
My immediate task will be to continue with the process of reversing the effects COVID-19 has had on our economy and on our lives.
His promise is a $17 billion program to boost growth after the pandemic hit the price of oil and cocoa exports. That caused one of West Africa's largest economies to suffer its first quarterly contraction in nearly 40 years. But he will also be under pressure to rein government spending. The debt-to-GDP ratio is now above 70%, prompting warnings from the International Monetary Fund. In his speech, Akufo-Addo also acknowledged the tight race and said it was a sign that Ghanaians want his ruling NPP party and Mahama's NDC to work together.
Now is the time for each and every one of us, irrespective of our political affiliation, to unite, join hands, stand shoulder to shoulder, and work hard to place Ghana where she deserves to be.
Mahama's party has, however, rejected the results, calling the election flawed and discredited. Police have reported more than 60 incidents of violence since the morning of the election, resulting in 5 deaths.
A few days after the announcement of the election results, the main opposition party, the National Democratic Congress, is calling for an independent forensic investigation into the elections. Former President John Dramani Mahama says the conclusion of the inquiry will determine the opposition party's next move. In an exclusive VOA interview with Peter Clotty, Mahama says the Electoral Commission must learn from the errors it committed to ensure they are never repeated in future polls.
But I think that the incompetence the EC has shown, you know, it will be useful for us to do a forensic audit of the EC's own systems and the numbers to come to what the final number for the EC is. Because as of now, I don't know what number they're going to gazette.
But Mr. President, what is your reaction to the African Union poll observer mission that came out saying that the elections were transparent and credible and that most people were not prevented from voting? The ECOWAS poll observer mission led by Madame Johnson Sirleaf said the same thing, that it was peaceful and transparent. So what do you say to these prominent African organizations that monitor the poll, pretty much giving a stamp of approval to the elections?
Normally, when you have an observer mission like that, you need to wait and see their final report, because often they give the report up to the point of counting. And it's true, I mean, the whole day was peaceful. People went about, you know, voting without any problems. and the queues were orderly. And so they'll say all that. And there were a few instances of people caught with pre-printed ballot sheets. I mean, the video evidence is there. Normally, their final report will capture the collation process. And so this report does not capture the collation process. And a lot went wrong with the collation process.
With me to discuss the results of the elections in Ghana are Peter Cloti, host of VOA's Nightline Africa, who is in Accra, the capital of Ghana, covering the elections. Also from Accra, we're joined by political analyst Clara Berry Kasati. And from Washington, D.C., we're joined by Kwaku Nwoma, professor of international politics at American University. And he is a Ghanaian citizen. Welcome to Straight Talk Africa, ladies and gentlemen.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
You're welcome. I want to start with you, Peter. You've been covering this process from Accra for us, from Ghana. And we see after the results, some are jubilating, but not everybody's happy. So up to this point, what's going on? How has been the reaction from the citizens?
Well, it has been quiet. When the chairperson of the Electoral Commission, attorney Jean Adukwe Mensah, declared incumbent President Nana Addo-Dankwa Akufo-Addo as duly elected, his supporters from the New Patriotic Party celebrated throughout the night. I went in the streets, spoke with a lot of people. They were very happy. Some of them were extending a hand of friendship, calling on the losing side, former President John Dramani Mahama, to join and concede defeat, as they said. However, supporters of the main opposition National Democratic Congress are unhappy because their leaders have been holding a series of news conferences complaining about what they described as rigged election. They said some of the numbers did not add up.
If we go to Ghana, Clara, I wanted to ask you this. Just before the elections, we actually witnessed pockets of violence across the country. Supporters of incumbent Nana Addo-Dankwa Akufo-Addo's party, New Patriotic Party, and also those John Dramani Mahama, clashed. People died. What really triggered this way before even the election took place?
The clash between political opponents is not new in Ghana, in the sense that since independence, I think right after independence, elections have generally in Ghana been very heavily, quite keenly contested, and occasionally or sometimes we do have pockets of confrontation between political opponents and all of that. Of course, we're disappointed. The expectation was that given where we have reached in our democratic journey, we didn't expect in 2020 we would still have some of the clashes. But yes, there were isolated cases of violence or clashes between the supporters of the two political parties. But to a very large extent, these were isolated incidents in that they were not widespread violent, and they occurred at places that are usually known to be hotspots during election hours because of the tendency for political opponents or supporters of the major political parties to engage in some form of violence. But to a very large extent, this is reducing.
Mm-hmm. Professor Nwoma, this, as Clara mentions, has been witnessed before, you know, these tensions, these clashes, and we saw that this time around there were even accusations of disenfranchisement of fellow citizens. Sometimes there were accusations that the ruling party was messing up with even the election voter verification process. What does this tell us about the system? Was the country properly prepared? Was the Electoral Commission properly prepared in order to remove any issues, to do away with any issues that could cause this kind of tensions during the process?
Well, thanks for the question. What it tells us is that the system is not perfect, but it seems to be working. We've always had these problems. It's how they are managed by the leaders of political parties that determines whether we're going to see further escalation or not. The EC itself has, there's a lot of confidence in the EC, the way it's done its work. There's been questions here and there, but generally they've performed very well under a lot of pressure. And I think that we have to distinguish between the political arguments that are being made and the legal arguments that will follow. If there's proof that there's been some kind of, shenanigans going on, going to court and providing evidence to support that is a little different than going to a rally and making claims that may or may not be true. I think the political parties do themselves a huge disservice when they build up expectations and they go out and they tell their supporters that this is an election that has been won, even though the results has not been called yet. They create this crisis of expectation, which usually leads to violence when the results come out and it doesn't match what we expect. But in terms of the security aspects of managing elections, the institutions are there. They are not as strong as we would like them to be, but generally they've performed well. And if you look at pre-election surveys that came out, I can refer to the CDD survey, for example, done in October, that people generally have confidence in the EC. And I think that they've discharged their duties very well. We see that the playing field was quite level because look at how much seats the opposition has won in parliament. It's hard to do that in a badly run election. And so we need to look at the whole picture, some of the positive trends. Incumbents that lost, over 100 sitting MPs are not returning. That's not a system that, a system that's manipulated usually favors the incumbents. A lot of people that thought they had safe seats have been voted out. So there's something bigger going on. I just hope that, understand that there's pain when you lose an election. I just hope that the leaders of the opposition, if they have a case, will encourage their supporters to cool down and wait for their day in court.
And Clara, we know that there were accusations and then counter accusations. For example, in the Eastern Volta region, the NDC stronghold accused the government of voter intimidation there. And this was when security forces were deployed there because of the COVID situation. But in turn, also, NPP accused the NDC of attempting to register foreigners in the Borno region, which borders Cote d'Ivoire. So these accusations and counter-accusations, were they very localized, or was this a strategy by both parties so that if you lose, you can always make a claim that it's because of whatever was done before the election?
Generally, the accusations and counter-accusations happen virtually every electoral cycle since the Fourth Republic. Usually, the NDC would make accusations against the NPP in the Ashanti region, and the NPP would make accusations against the NDC in the Volta region, because these are the respective strongholds of the two parties. When it comes to the suspicion, when it comes to the electoral body, it's not new for the electoral cycle. I am not aware that we have ever held elections since the Fourth Republic, and either of the two parties has, after losing an election, has agreed that they lost fairly and squarely. Each time we have had issues. And I think the reason, to some extent, is not completely unfounded in the sense that because of the way institutionally our constitution provides for the setup of the institutions. If you look at the Ghanaian 1992 constitution, for example, it is the president who appoints virtually everybody else, including those who are the independent institutions. This has usually caused suspicion among the opposition, whoever is opposition member at the time, that there would be collusion between the EC in this case and the ruling party or the party that appointed the election commissioners at the time. So this again is not new. The accusations against the EC are not new. What usually is new is who is doing the accusation. If this one lost, they are the ones to do the accusation, and not the one who appointed the government in power. So going forward, in terms of improvement, I think as a country, if we are really serious about strengthening institutions, we have to go back and take another look at those constitutional provisions with respect to appointment, so that it can foster confidence that whoever occupies the institution at the time is not interested in helping anybody but doing what they are required to do.
Yes. Now, Peter, in the process of, you know, going around and covering the process from before the election on the actual election day, you also spoke to election observers. What did you hear generally in terms of the conduct of the electoral process?
Well, Vincent, election organization and management in Ghana, you know, has its own challenges. However, the Electoral Commission is usually helped by an inter-party advisory committee known as IPAC that brings up issues, and then the Electoral Commission officials usually try to address them. And that was the same thing. For the first time, we had the Coalition of Domestic Election Observers, known as CODEO, that worked hand-in-hand with the Electoral Commission, particularly, you know, organizing this election under COVID-19. And some of the things that usually happen in terms of education, in terms of civic education, let me add that, in terms of political participation in a lot of areas did not happen. Some of these NGOs did not have the funding that they would need to help educate and engage the masses in voter education, among others. And they were telling me when I spoke with officials of CODEO that there were only two major political parties participating in activities across the country. The minor political parties were not present. And so it was only their supporters who benefited with the kind of engagement that they tried to do. And that is why they said that the overwhelming results were for both the ruling or the governing New Patriotic Party and the main opposition, the National Democratic Congress. Now, that is not saying that the minor political parties don't have support, but the groundswell of support for these two major parties are overwhelming, I must add. Now, the Electoral Commission on its own did what it says it wanted to do. Sometimes they are accused of not addressing some of the concerns the political parties present, particularly the main opposition party, the National Democratic Congress, raised a number of issues. The Electoral Commission officials that I spoke with said they addressed all the issues in the run-up to the election. So sometimes you see the accusations that you spoke about earlier on coming up when sometimes the elections are going to be held. And the losing candidate usually, or the losing party usually, comes up with a plethora of accusations and misgivings about certain things that they think should have been done in a certain way that did not happen, and they cry foul as a result of that. Mm-hmm. It has happened before. The governing party did the same when they were in opposition. They went to the court. They had a stolen verdict written as a book and all that. So this, Ghanaians are aware of some of these things that happen during the elections.
It's like it's the name of the game. But again, I think the fact that there were so many political parties and candidates is evidence of the vibrance of the Ghanaian democracy. Professor Nuoma, let's now turn to the challenges that the president faces in his second term. We know that he has promised to implement a $17 billion program to boost Ghana's economy. And this is after the coronavirus pandemic really hit the country hard in the sectors of oil and cocoa exports. Now, just give us a sense of your understanding of what this will mean, what it really needs to do, and how we'll prioritize the spending of this money.
Okay, so Ghana was actually not doing too badly before COVID. So if you look at all the projections from the World Bank, the economy was healthy, and then COVID came. And even in spite of that, the president really has gotten credit, I think deservedly so, for how the COVID crisis was managed. But everybody's going to come out of this COVID pandemic with an economic problem that has to be handled. There were promises that were made, and when you make a promise, you write a check. Those checks will be due now that he has a second mandate. And the question is whether he's learned lessons that come from his inability to deliver on some of the promises that were made in the first term. The campaign promise was 4 more years to do more. Now he has that 4 years, and we'll see if he's able to deliver on the promises that were made. Some of the problems are structural, so he's going to have to figure out how to get people back to work. He's going to have to figure out how to get the financial sector working again. It was plagued by all kinds of problems. He's going to have to figure out how to get Ghana's exports going again. The macro infrastructure still needs a lot of work, and he's going to have to deal with that, inflation, all those problems. But he's also going to have to deal with problems that are of a personal and closer nature. So charges of nepotism, for example, and corruption that went uninvestigated because it involved people around him. He's going to have to do a better job on that. I think that there's going to be a honeymoon period because the COVID has bought him a little bit of a cushion. But after that, I think people are going to be expecting this. And the question is whether he still thinks that he has to deliver on these promises, or he thinks that now that he has won a second term, his work is done and is actually just focusing on legacy. And this, from what I've seen, I think that he understands that this is an invitation to aggressively address the problems and not coast and think that, well, my work is done because I've been reelected and I don't have another election coming. Yeah. Because people are still suffering in Ghana. And so I hope that he takes this mandate seriously and he addresses the problems in a way that shows seriousness and a dedication to the task ahead.
Yes. Now, Claro, we know that he did actually get some credit for trying to help people, cushion them against the impact of the pandemic economically. He even gave some subsidies in the area of electricity. But at the same time, the International Monetary Fund is warning that Ghana is in trouble. It's in trouble because of government spending that has pushed the debt-to-GDP ratio past 70%, which puts the country in jeopardy. How does this work when, at the same time, the president is saying he's going to implement a $17 billion program?
That we wait see, because like Professor Nyama talked about, a lot of freebies are given all to cushion some kind of relief to cushion the citizens of Ghana. And we know that we are not exactly doing very well financially. So all of these are coming back to the economy to help us in the next year, from 2021 going, particularly also because of promises of more free education, particularly towards the university, whether that will be rolled out or not. But invariably, like many African countries, I've always said of what my research reveals is that after the independence, we did very little to change the economic structure of the structure of our economy. So that very largely the structures of our economy are still the way they were during the colonial times, or what the colonial administration left, which is not helping very much because the colonial setup wasn't made to develop the economy totally. It was made more to exploit the resources of the country rather than empower businesses. So I think going forward, the government has to come back and take another look at the structure of the economy to see how this time you can aim to boost local production. There should be more investment within Ghanaian people to boost food, for example. Food is one of the things that Ghana imports. So we have to go back. I think largely the structure of the economy has to be taken. We have to take another look at it and see what gains we can make and what improvements that we can make.
Yeah, and indeed, for the economy to grow, Ghana needs to look into its resources. It's a rich country. There's some oil, there is cocoa, there are other minerals. And to that effect, the government had promised to revitalize the economy by implementing this program, which they called the National Industrial Revitalization Program, or NRP, and this was meant to revive the private sector growth and stimulate the broader industrialization. Now, Peter, you may not have focused too much on that, but have you heard of this? Are people aware of this revitalization program? Is there any evidence that this thing is there and it's working?
Well, a lot of the supporters that I spoke with, including the campaign chairman, is are of the view that the mandate has been given to Nana Addo-Dankwa Akufo-Addo and that he is going to jumpstart the economy with this program to create more jobs for the youth. And they said the free senior high school policy is meant to usher in skilled or secondary school students who will be trained. And if they are unable to further their education to the tertiary institutions, they will be able to be trained for some of these jobs. Now, those who have graduated from university, they have a similar program to employ them, including nurses and teachers and all that. But it remains to be seen if the actualization will happen in the first, second, or third year. It remains to be seen if the president will be able to carry out or keep his promises of jumpstarting the economy with this program to help resolve some of the high unemployment among the country's youth.
And now, talking about the country's youth, Professor Nuamand, you're a teacher. It has been said also that Ghana's problem is the education system does not prepare the young people for the workplace. How does Ghana, in that process of revitalizing the economy by kind of building up other industries besides even the oil production area, how does it tailor the education to the workplace, a modern workplace, to transform Ghana into a powerful economy in that region?
It's only Ghana. Basically, our educational system is one that favors the Enlightenment-based liberal education model that came with colonialism. I don't want to put all of the problems there because Ghana's educational system has been diversified greatly in the last 20 years or so, where there are so many different universities and so many different avenues for skill training that if you really wanted to, you could find something to do that will prepare you for the market. And I don't want to dismiss liberal arts and liberal education, which usually people attack, because basically it's how we learn the science of thinking. Now, what you do with that after you've graduated, it's a different story, and there should be other opportunities. You need an entire ecosystem that allows people to take the skills that they learn in school and to turn them into productive activities. And that's what's missing in the Ghanaian system. We don't have a value chain that produces opportunities for jobs, for people to get entrepreneurial training, to get on the job skill training, those kinds of opportunities, internships, or even if you wanted to start a business, money to start a business, a seed capital. There's all this stuff. You need to have these things in play before people can actually fully utilize the education that they get in school. So check people that go to technical schools and learn engineering at a place like Kwame Nkrumah University, for example. They come out, they can do things, but they are not the jobs that they need are not there in the system. So you need an entire ecosystem that facilitates those kinds of transitions that creates opportunities. But the core educational system, I think it works well. You need to add things to it. You need to create opportunities. You have young people out there. They need opportunities to acquire other skills even after they leave school. Maybe there's the need for some kind of curriculum reform. The government has promised some of that. Maybe you need to change pedagogy, the way things are taught. That's always something that you can always do. You can always improve. But the reason why there's unemployment in Ghana is not necessarily because of the educational system. It's a whole bunch of other things that need to be in play in order to allow people to get jobs. And the government, quickly, if I can comment on the government's industrialization policy, the One District, One Factory program, for example, it's fantastic, except that they are bringing back import substitution industrialization to fix an unemployment problem. Unemployment is much more than that. You need to address the labor force participation factors. You need to figure out why people don't have the skills that you need. And if you need to create more technical schools, provide those. Otherwise, you can have factories and not have people